You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and you can listen to the program every Wednesday at 5 o'clock after calendar or from the podcast page whenever you feel like it. Just go online to kptz.org. Well, today we are going to be talking to John Larrison. Now, John is quite the outdoors person, and so it follows that his book, Whiskey When We're Dry, a novel, shows off kind of the outdoors person and experiences that he's had. But this is historical fiction, and it's definitely got a contemporary twist. I would say it's a Western with contemporary issues. So Larrison, John, has worked as a freelance writer for outdoor magazines. He has been a writing instructor and still may be, we'll ask him about that, and also a fly fishing guide. His first book was a how-to text on fly fishing, The Complete Steelheader, and he went on to publish two fishing-related novels, Northwest of Normal in 2009 and Holding Lies in 2011. His most recent novel, Whiskey When We're Dry, was a Los Angeles Times and Seattle Times bestseller, an Indie Next picked, and a finalist for the Ken Kesey Award. It is also a Port Townsend Library Community Read selection for 2020. So welcome, John. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
So, first thing that people want to know is, how did you come to write this Western story with a lot of really interesting characters and a totally different perspective than the traditional Western?
You know, I think people assume, I certainly did, that writers always design their novels ahead of time. And I think some novelists do that, but I didn't do that here. I was working on another novel that I had sort of designed, and I was out walking one night and listening to Gillian Welch's music, the song Ruination Day. And when the song ended, if you know that song, it has this sort of this rhythm that feels almost like a horse's walking gait.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up on horses, and so that's kind of a familiar rhythm to me. And anyway, when that song ended, I heard this elderly voice in my ear, and was just so compelled by this voice. You know, and if you aren't a writer and you hear voices, you need help, psychological help. But if you are a writer, you run home and you get to work, and that's what I did. And really, this voice, you know, guided the story. The voice decided what the book was, who the other characters were, and really, I felt like I was transcribing what the voice said, and was less a novelist, less like designing something, and more just listening.
That's what you want to have happen, don't you? That's great.
Yeah, it wasn't an easy experience. The book took a long time to get right, but it was definitely the most rewarding experience I'd had creatively up till that moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I'm hoping that you'll read from the book a little bit, because I think then people can really get a good sense of it.
Sure. I'll read to you what the voice said into my ear that night.
Mm.
This final draft of the book is draft 23, and a lot has changed over the 23 drafts, but nothing about what I'm going to read to you here has changed. This is all the way I heard it that first night. I heard it said, God moves on the water. Well, I've looked for him there. My thirst grows with his flood. Our kin homesteaded where desert met lake. The hills in the near distance wore blankets of pine. Patterns of aspen marked the water. Beyond them, the mountains stood blue on clear days and devoured the sun long before it left this world. From the home Paul built us, we couldn't see the lake, but we could see the willows along its edge, and we could hear the wingbeats of doves. bison calves still wandered in with the heifers, and arrowheads clung to their shafts. This autumn air delivers me there still. They arrived in 1864 by the deed I once held in my hand. Paul was fresh from the war, and on a horse he took off for Johnny Reb. Pa told us he was a Yankee sharpshooter through the first 2 years of that war. He come home after to his family and found his own father's grave and his mother under the watch of a new man and his kid brother dying of infection. He stayed until the brother passed and then rode west. Pa killed many men. I know that for certain, but he wasn't the kind to talk of it. Ma was Spanish-speaking. Her kin was at some point subjects of Spain, France, Mexico, and the United States by the time they was forced from their home by Sam Houston and Santa Anna and the thousands of American settlers coming for what had been theirs. They fled the only direction without guns and come to settle in Kansas, peaceful, land-rich Kansas. By the time Ma was a marrying age, the war was kicking, and the raiders come from Missouri, and John Brown come from within, and soon it was bloody torn to bits, Kansas. Her intended was shot one night for no good reason at all, and her brother who joined the fighting returned ill of mind. Kansas wasn't Kansas no more. They rode on. She was 22 and walking with a load on her shoulders somewhere in the plains when she heard a horse gaining, and turned to see Pa slowing on her. Of course, he wasn't Pa yet. He was a stranger who introduced himself as Milt Harney. She said folks called her Rosa, her mother's name. I don't know what she thought of him, but I know he memorized her details. There was sweat through her dress and flies so thick from the oxen she gave up waving them off. A rare sight, a shapely girl without child or man. You hear Paul tell it? Wasn't no west after he saw her, just the direction she was walking. He took up with the uncle and leader of the clan. Traveling poor as they done was slow work, no riding for those with legs. Folks now talk like everybody rode west, but not many could afford a riding horse. So it was footwork and loads and dust so thick it turned your lungs to chalk. Paul had that horse, and her uncle must have been looking to slip out from under his burden. A week on, they was married by the book of a revivalist and a circle of wagons as a church. After crossing the divide, they broke off on their own for the valley that would become our home. A barrel of sugar by autumn, he promised her. Paul would be a cattleman, and to him that occupation promised wealth and maybe a mountain to name as his own. To start, he got homestead acres and unspoken grazing access to the nearby Indian lands. There was a lake, and the valley held its green long after the hills went to brown. When they arrived, she was already grown with child. Ma wept when she saw the valley. Cranes danced at sunrise, and wildflowers shone like embers in the grass. Here no view reminded her of someone she'd lost. Noah come along that autumn. Noah, my brother's name. Even now I turn and expect to see him riding hard for supper. How many times did I push back the cowhide flap and see him leading a string of dust down the valley? Never late for grub and never one to show up on a dry horse, that brother of mine. You knew him best, but you didn't know him then, before. Sure, you've heard the stories folks tell. They make him a killer and a hellion. Little children hear his name, Noah Harney, and they see men falling from stagecoaches and smoke rising from a barrel, and they think a man is made real by the violence he wields. Noah was a killer, that is certain. I ain't never been sure if he was right.
You've been listening and captivated by the voice of author John Larrison reading from his book, Whiskey When We're Dry, and it is the selection of the Port Townsend Library for the community read. So, John, it's hard for me to start talking because I was just there and listening again. There was so much foreshadowing of what was to come in your characters and the place where it all takes place. Did you start by deciding that this was going to be set in the high desert along the trail?
You know, I say that the book started with the voice, and definitely the book did start for me with that voice, but I think its seeds were planted long ago in my time in the high desert of eastern Oregon. When I was a kid, 6 or 7 years old, I spent about a year off and on Heart Mountain Wildlife Refuge in eastern Oregon. And, you know, they're like bighorn sheep and antelope and mule deer. There are arrowheads all over the place because people have hunted there for thousands of years. And it's one of these places that just sort of crawled into my imagination and has never left. And when I heard that voice on my shoulder, I think it was just sort of natural that that the character somehow had been forged by that place, that felt just you know, sort of true on a level that I didn't even need to express to myself when I heard the voice.
Well, you traveled a lot as a young person. Your parents were involved with National Geographic, I believe I read. So you've been to a lot of probably really amazing places. But did something happen there? Did you start writing that year, or when did you know that you were going to be a writer?
I knew I was going to be a writer in kindergarten. My kindergarten teacher, you know, I was getting in trouble all the time, and I was always coming up with these reasons why I did the things I did. And at one point, my kindergarten teacher said, "You know, someday you're going to grow up and be a writer." And that was just like deep in the back of my mind. That sort of came to pass. But I've noticed that, as you said, you know, my folks made films for National Geographic, and they themselves grew up on farms. And so there's always been this interesting kind of contradiction in all the traveling we did. We were also really kind of grounded to the places that we went. And I was always interested especially in how people, you know, found the food that they needed in those places, usually by fishing was the answer. So I got really into fishing at a young age. And what I've noticed now, you know, as an adult, as a writer, that all of those places I spent time as a kid are in me. And they want to write stories. They want stories to grow out of those places. And the American West, but especially Eastern Oregon, you know, was so formative to me that it made sense that the first time I was going to write a big, serious novel, that I would set the novel in a place like that one.
Well, let's talk about our main voice, our main character, Jesselyn Harney. We're introduced to her speaking as an elder in the reading that you just finished. But she starts, then the story begins, you know, kind of at the beginning when she's pretty young. One thing I noticed right away was she, you know, she talks really differently. And even as a young girl, and there's expressions like, well, it was ill of mind, and he grew me on, and just the language that you use is so particular. And I was wondering how you found that. Did in your research, or did you know people that spoke that way?
Yeah, I have. You know, the answer is the language sort of came from many sources. I sort of think part of the writing process, I think, is sort of like being a sponge. You know, you squeeze yourself out until the sponge is dry, and then you let it soak up the things around you. And you try to curate the things around you so you soak up the right stuff. But language was, you know, central to the voice. And though I heard that voice in its kind of whole shape in the early pages of the book, Jesse has to talk about a lot of things, and so I had to learn about how Jesse would learn, or how Jesse would come to talk about those things. And to do that, I read old letters that pioneers had written. I read old novels that were written long ago that contained some of that original jargon and dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe most influentially, I came to, I just sat with people who are older, who have lived in Eastern Oregon or other parts of the West their whole lives for multiple generations. And a lot of this language is still alive in these people. You don't see it on TV because these aren't the people who end up on television, and if they do, they have to talk in the standard dialect. But
right.
When you're in the grocery store in Burns, Oregon, the people in line ahead of you may be talking in a way that would sound almost, like the accent of another country if you've only been to the supermarket in Portland or Seattle.
That's for sure. So she shortens her name to Jesse. And then she decides she really can't be on the ranch by herself. Her brother is gone, or her father. I don't want to give any plot lines away here, but she's by herself. And, the reader just keeps thinking, okay, what's she going to do? What would I do? So talk about her relationship with her horse and, what she decides to do. How did that come to be?
Sure. An essential part of the research for the book for me was going to places where I imagined these scenes to be set. Though the book isn't set in a singular real place, all the scenes are set in a real place that I've been. And so when I was working on those scenes, I'd go to those places and sit there and try to be Jesse in those places. And so one time I was sitting overlooking this, sagebrush basin, and it was like May, but it started to snow on me.
Mm.
And I was alone, and I'm wearing comfortable modern clothes and everything, but I'm trying to like imagine what Jesse would think if she was there. And it occurred to me just how important her horse would be to her. That she's someone who's grown up without the comforts of friends, because she lives so far away. And she's grown up without a mom, and here is her horse is a mare. It's more than just transportation for her. And so the book was much longer, and at one point, and a lot of those pages were the relationship between Jesse and her horse and how that relationship comes to form. I grew up with horses myself. I never had that mm-hmm. deep bond with them, but once I was older and I looked back, I kind of wished that I had, that I'd taken the time to get to know the horses. And this was maybe an opportunity for me to do that in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you are listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and we're talking to John Larrison, the author of Whiskey When We're Dry, and some other books about fishing, if you're interested in those. And I just want to read Timothy Egan's little review of this. Timothy Egan, as you know, is the New York Times bestselling author of The Worst Hard Time, among many other books that we have talked about here on Book Lovers Cafe. And he says, a thunderclap of originality. Here is a fresh voice and a fresh take on one of the oldest stories we tell about ourselves as Americans and Westerners. It's riveting in all the right ways, a damn good read that stayed with me long after closing the covers. Congratulations, John.
That was a happy day when I read that.
I bet. So we talked a little bit about the research. Let's get into really what happens to Jesse. She goes from Jessalyn to Jesse, and she has to learn something about masculinity in the West and acting seasoned. What happens to her on her quest to find her brother?
Yeah,
that's a big question, but one of the things.
It's an important one. She as a writer, you know, you have to, even, so Jesse's very different than I am, right? Like, if you look at my author photo, you'll see that I don't probably look like the character of this book. But still, as a writer, I had to tap into what's true about my life that's true about Jesse's life. And so every sentence, you know, has to come from truth. And so as a novelist, you have to be sort of selective about the parts that you pick to write about so that you can keep it true. And what was really true about Jesse's experience that was also true about my own was this idea of putting on a show of masculinity. And I think every young man does this. It's what every teenage boy is doing from middle school on. You know, they're thinking about what the older males that they admire do, and they try to do those same things. And so Jesse, you know, she doesn't want to just be a man. She wants to be a seasoned man. And to her, that means someone who doesn't get, who strangers are wary of. You know, this is a time when the world is rough and violence can come quickly and out of nowhere. And the man who looks intimidating is the one that nobody harasses. And so she intends to be that kind of person. And she studies the mannerisms that that she sees from those kinds of men and tries to be those kind of men. And as the novel goes on, you know, in the beginning, you know, she calls herself Jesseline. She wears a dress. For the middle of the book, she is, in my eyes, pretending to be this masculine man. And in the last third of the book, I see Jesse as kind of transcending these two dichotomies and becoming what Jesse is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, I think if we were to ask Jesse at the end of the book, are you a man or are you a woman, Jesse would say, I'm me.
Right, right. She goes through a lot, and she survives a lot. There's a lot of casual violence in this era, and even today, of course. You can't help but think about our world today and things that happened in 1885. But one of the things I noticed was, you know, the importance of, and we're talking about masculinity again, the kind of gun that you have and how you handle that gun as a sort of a status symbol. And then also the idea of a masculine activity of gambling and wagering. And it, you kind of go from card playing to, you know, human beings and sharpshooters, and then even into wagering on a duel where someone's going to die. That's quite the trajectory.
It's so astute of you, though, to mention the parallels between the current moment and, you know, this formative time in our past. Somewhere along the way, I realized this was a coming-of-age story of Jesse, but it was also the coming-of-age story of the country. You know, that's what the Western has become in you know, the canon of literature. It's one of these American coming-of-age stories. And the elements of the book that you mention are all elements that trouble me about our contemporary moment. And so I was able to use the book as a way to explore the earlier forms of these troubling dynamics about American culture. I'm a football fan. And I, you know, I was raised watching football, and there's so much about football that I intellectually find abhorrent, and yet I'm still compelled to watch it. And then I read books by people like Michael Bennett, you know, the Seattle Seahawk, former Seahawk football player, in which, you know, he offers this incredible critique of football. And anyway, I came to see these earlier elements of our culture as being places where we could see the problems of today, but in a slightly more clear form, where we're abstracted from the contemporary moment and we're able to see these troublesome dynamics in their more fundamental form. And that was an exciting part of the writing for me. It was also the part of the writing that allowed me, I think, to come to think of our culture in new ways. and see potentials in ourselves that we might not see if we just looked in the mirror in this moment.
Mm-hmm. We have to talk a little bit about Noah Harney, the brother, because, you know, most of the way through the book, we're thinking of him as this stereotypic outlaw killer. And then when we meet him, the myth changes. And you're able to talk about religious issues. He's kind of a messiah, a charismatic figure. But he also, you know, loves people. And, you know, he loves all kinds of people. So that you work that in and you're not hitting people over the head with it. It feels natural in the story. So how did you decide to create Noah in that way?
You know, Noah is really born out of this time. 1880s is a fascinating time in the American West. The Wild West has been dead for maybe 30 years. And what has replaced it is this industrial West, which depends on the romance of the West continuing to lure a laboring class to the West to do the work so that the wealthy can make money. It's not unlike the current moment in so many ways. And Noah is one of these characters who is really heavily influenced by Butch Cassidy, you know, a real-life outlaw. Butch Cassidy was raised on a small cattle ranch in Utah that was put out of business by a much bigger rancher who was really an industrialist connected to the railroads. And Butch Cassidy hated his father for being reduced, run out of business by this big industrialist. Butch Cassidy leaves the ranch and he goes to work for another big rancher and eventually falls into this life of stealing from the industrialists and becomes a folk hero in the West. Butch Cassidy was hunted by the Pinkertons, and the big capitalists in the United States on the East Coast painted Butch Cassidy as a really bad killer. And in truth, Butch Cassidy only killed one person, and it was the Sundance Kid.
Mm-hmm. So besides Butch Cassidy, I mean, there's Brokeback Mountain here, there's Lonesome Dove here, there's a lot of contemporary writing about the West and characters. And I want to let everybody know that there's a lot within these pages, and you'll read it in a couple of sittings because it certainly is a page-turner. We've been talking to John Larrison. He's the author of Whiskey When We're Dry. And all the best to you, John, and we'll see you in Port Townsend.
I can't wait to come. Thank you.
Okay. We'll go out and we'll play a little bit of Gillian Welch, and join us next time on Book Lovers Cafe. Bye-bye.